Welcome to Inside Missions, a production of Maranatha Volunteers International, offering an in-depth look at the people, the cultures, and the countries where Maranatha is working. I'm Dustin Kamm, and I'm joined today by our Vice President of Marketing, Julie Lee. Julie, welcome to Inside Missions.
Thank you for having me.
So Julie, you've been working for Maranatha a long time. You've traveled around the world covering stories of Maranatha. Sometimes they say that, you know, once you find your career, you can kind of see some echoes of that when you were a kid. Are there any things that you can point to? Oh, yeah, I used to do this, and it ties in with what I do now.
I mean, I think I've always been interested in reading and writing. So ever since I was a little kid, I always tell people my first dream was to be a writer and to be a teacher. And so those two things have always been a huge part of who I was in terms of how I thought of myself in the future. I've always been interested in storytelling and the magic of storytelling, the power of it, and also in the idea of being able to inspire people through things that you can learn together. So maybe those things pointed to my career now.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that you wanted to be a teacher. Are there any aspects of teaching or education that you feel like you have kind of just brought with you, like that desire to, you know, educate others in any way in this job?
You mean in this current job? I think so. I think everything that we do is really about an exchange of information with the new people, places that we encounter in life. And every time I go on a trip, I'm always thinking about what I'm learning from this experience. So that's one way where I can be forever a student. But then I also think about how does this experience that I'm learning about, how can that be translated into an experience that others can learn from? And so I think in the way I think of my stories or in my presentations or in the scripts that we write for Maranatha Mission Stories, I want it to be educational in a way so that with every experience that we have in the mission field or out in the world, we're kind of continuing to learn and build ourselves as people and Christians.
Well, that's good writing too, right? To be able to put people in a situation that they've never been in because you're experiencing it and you're able to kind of, you understand the things that they maybe wouldn't understand as far as context that you have to provide.
Yeah, I think that it is kind of extraordinary how it all worked out, right? Because it's, while we're not writing fiction here, we're not writing fiction, but we are definitely having to translate, and you know this because you're a fellow writer, we're having to translate these incredible experiences we're having out in the field into words or into a script that can then also partner with visuals to tell a story. And I think that takes a lot of creativity. And I remember sometimes earlier when I started at Maranatha, I would have to write about places that I hadn't been. For example, I wrote a story about Carl Schwinn, who had done quite a bit of work for us in Afghanistan. And I wasn't going to go to Afghanistan just to know what it was like, but I would listen to what he told me in his words and look at his pictures. And then while I was writing it, just reimagine that picture in my mind, close my eyes, and try to kind of picture what it would have been like to be in there. And so it takes a lot of imagination, I think, to rebuild that in your head and then let that translate into words on a page. And I really enjoy that. I do that quite often, just kind of trying to imagine myself in that space and then figuring out how I'm going to express that to the reader.
It's an art form for sure. Yeah. But going back to your story, at what point did you connect with Maranatha?
So right after I graduated from PUC, I was offered a permanent position at the public relations office. I don't know how long I had been there. And then I got a call from Kyle Feese, who at the time was the director of marketing at Maranatha. And he had gotten my name from Bonnie Dwyer, who was then the editor of Spectrum. And I had worked with her on a couple of articles as a student. And she recommended me to him because he was looking for a writer. And so I remember him talking to me for quite a while, doing a phone interview. And then I was really excited at the idea. And I was invited to come to the office in Sacramento. And we did an interview. I remember it was a rainy day, so I was a few minutes late. Thank goodness they gave me grace. But I met with him, and it was great. Did another follow-up interview with him and Kenneth Weiss, who was the vice president back then also, and I got the job. So that's how I got here. Thanks, Bonnie.
And what was your role? What was your job at that point? Just, we didn't have a TV show then, so what were some of the things that you were...
Everything we were doing was, back then we had Maranatha Matters twice a month. We had...
It's our email.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Our email newsletter, and now it's 4 times a month or every week. We had the magazine, which was 4 times a year, of course, and then we had project packets. And so I was writing a lot of that, press releases, pitching stories to our local Adventist papers and to national Adventist papers, the way we still do now. But like you said, we didn't have social media, television, online stuff. We had some web stuff, actually. But
do you think it's gotten harder to connect with our audience with the... There's just so many different options, and people are spread out on so many different things, social media, technology-wise. Some people are only print. Is it more complicated in any way now? Was it a simpler time back then when it was mostly print?
It was a simpler time in terms of things to do for one writer. I mean, back then it was Kyle, me, and Heather, who is still with us, Heather Bergren, and she's a graphic designer, and we were able to kind of get everything done. I do think it's more complicated, obviously. There's so much more you have to think about with anything that's online, digital. And whether or not it's harder to reach people, I think it's actually easier. We just have a broader way to get in contact with people in many different ways. Yes, more opportunities, but it probably is harder to capture people's attention.
So you're doing a lot of writing. Are you traveling much at this point?
Yes.
What was your first Maranatha trip like? Where was it? When was it?
I'm pretty sure I started in March of 2001, and I think my first project was Ultimate Workout that summer, and we went to Costa Rica, and I...
And this is our teens...
Yes, our teens mission only
trip,
mission
trip. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been going on for quite a while. And I remember back then, that was back now, most of the whole project is kind of centered at one location, correct? But back then, there were maybe 5 different sites. And so I remember being in a car driving from site to site to site, interviewing people on probably a tape recorder and paper, and just trying to gather these stories, these fragments of stories, and piecing it together. And, it was really phenomenal. I thought it was just a really phenomenal experience for me. And I read the story, and I remember Don Noble, I think he really liked the story. And that was a big deal to me, yeah. Of course, just a kid, that the president liked it. But yeah, that was my first mission trip.
And then Maranatha Mission Stories, our television program, started within a few years of that.
A version of it, yes.
Yeah. So were you going out on those trips to collect any stories for video? Or when did the TV show kind of enter your responsibilities? And what was that like to kind of shift from just writing to going into the field for different medium?
We were doing occasional videos here and there. I can't remember, because it was such a long time ago, whether or not my first time with video was actually a regular series or something even named Maranatha Mission Stories. I think we may have been doing kind of promotional videos for a country. Like, I remember doing one in the Dominican Republic and traveling together with different people to do that. And I remember even being asked to do a stand-up, which is when you're on camera and you say something directly to the camera to introduce or set context for whatever you're filming. And that was kind of exciting. But I think it was a few years after that, maybe like 4 years while I was working there, that it really started, we started establishing this idea of we want to start a regular television series called Maranatha Mission Stories. And and so I don't, I'll be honest, Dustin, I can't remember the details how often I traveled for that, but I do remember watching different videos and writing scripts and such, and it was quite a job, and it was something, it felt back then almost impossible. How are we going to do this with the staff that we have? But it's remarkable to look back on that and see how far we've come. So
absolutely. When you're on one of these trips, whether it was, you know, quite a while ago or recently, what is your mindset as you're traveling in this different country? You know, a lot of people who are familiar with Maranatha have been on a mission trip where it's more of a passive mindset. You're driven everywhere. You get off the shuttle or the van or whatever, you work, you do your... But when you're on a media collection trip or a television episode trip, what is the mindset like that you have?
I think that while there are times where we're just falling asleep in the car, especially me, because I can sleep anywhere, and there's a lot of photographic evidence of that. But I think we joke about this in our department. You know, we can't go on this big trip and not find a story. And that's our biggest fear, that you're going to travel all the way from California to Zambia and you're not going to have everything you need for a story. Because unlike writing, where you can still fill in the blanks with whatever happened, if you don't have visual evidence of it, you're sunk. And so I know for me personally, I'm vigilant as I'm looking out the window, watching the road pass by, or just thinking. And when you're there, you're working with the videographer to tell them what B-roll to capture. You're asking the local people, what's a story that you could do for the television show? Who can we interview? You listen, you kind of preview it, and then decide pass or yes. And so you're setting up, and as you're talking to people, your mind is constantly going, thinking of what's the next question? Where am I leading them? What is going to be the thread, the storyline that we're going to use? And then if they say something, tell an interesting story that you want to use, you have to tell yourself, how in the world are we going to illustrate that on video? So then I'm thinking about, well, we can go to their home and film them doing this. And so your mind is always going. And so, and then a couple of days in, I'm trying to make sure I have a whole outline of a show ready to go. And I write out an outline of, these are the things we need. And then you work with your videographer with a shot list and what else you need to capture with the field director there.
I don't know about you, but I always have a lot of anxiety on, especially the first half of the trip, because I'm just wanting to make sure that we get everything possible. Am I forgetting anything? You're keeping this overarching story in mind while you're also like focusing on the details of the day, and it kind of gets better, you know.
It does get
every
better
day. The cinematographer's like, how are you feeling today? Like, I think I'm feeling better. We have a lot more that we've gotten today, you know.
Yeah, the first couple days are very, very anxiety ridden, but then for me at least, when I write that outline and I feel like I've got a solid outline for a first act, second act, third act, then I start to relax, because then you know where the story's going and what you need to collect. So it does feel a lot better. But even then, I remember getting on that plane after a trip is over. I don't know if you feel this way, but like starting to panic while you're on the plane, like, wait a minute, did we get everything? Because you just can't go back to get it. So, but it's gotten better.
Okay, this is sort of a technical, like behind the scenes thing, but if we don't get a certain shot or we don't get something, what do we do?
I think you just have to be creative in the way you write your script, or sometimes we figure out B-roll, or
you could buy stock footage.
Yeah, you could buy stock footage. Or maybe you know that we were in Zambia 4 years ago and potentially you could use footage from that to cover a little bit of it. So it's, we figure it out. But it's always a better show if you can capture what you need on the ground.
And I will say, my anxiety has gotten a lot better the longer I've done this. I feel like more comfortable each time I go out. But certainly in the first few days, I'm always like, man, we got to keep filming. We gotta get, make sure, what if, because you never know, sometimes someone gets sick or you know, things
rains get, rain. I mean, we've had rain, or there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. It's not a relaxing trip for sure. They're long days too, because most of the time, you know this, we're on the road, and not good ones either. So just trying to get from destination to destination.
What is it like being on the road like that in another country? I guess it is a long period of time that sometimes we're gone, whether it's a week or 2 weeks. And I'm just wondering, being gone, especially from family for that long, how have you navigated that over the years?
You know, when I first, I worked at Maranatha for two different periods. Once was right after I got married. I worked here for about 5 years, and then I left to another job for about 7 years before I came back in 2012, and I've been here ever since. But I remember the first time going out, and it was interesting. To be honest, you know, you go out on these trips, and if your heart is really open to what we're doing as an organization and to all of the things that you can experience when you're traveling, if your heart and your mind is really open to that, you can't help but be changed with every trip that you go on. And I think it was Cuba. I think I went to Cuba in my first year at Maranatha. And I remember coming back home, and my husband had shaved his like goatee or something. So first of all, he looked a little bit different to me. And so that was kind of a funny parallel thing. But also I felt different. And I remember in that moment, I probably was 26 years old or so. I remember thinking, how in the world do I explain all of what's been happening to me or what I've been seeing to somebody who wasn't there with me? And it's a weird feeling to feel that, because it's a lot of what we experience out there. There are no words for it, right? It's just a process that's changing inside you as you're exposed to more and more of the world. And I remember being a little bit concerned about that, but it hasn't been an issue now. I mean, you just talk about it, and you talk about the things that you see, and he's really engaged in our organization in terms of reading all the things I write, because he's always my first set of eyes to tell me if it's horrible or not, my stories, and then also going to our conventions and watching our stories. But later then, as I went, when I came back to Maranatha, my oldest was 6 and my youngest was 2, and so it's hard. It's hard being a working mom, working dad. It's hard being away. But I think you have a good partner in somebody who really believes in the work that you do. And my husband does. And he was just very supportive. And my mom was very supportive. So my mom had just retired. And so she would just come anytime I had a trip. And so I think that the kids, like my youngest, doesn't really know any different. He knows that sometimes mom goes on these trips, but I think they come to our conventions. They've been on mission trips with me, and I think that they're proud of the work that we do, and they've never really complained about me being gone. But it is hard, especially as a mom. I feel guilt sometimes, but you just try to make sure that you have really good quality time when you are at home.
And they are a part of the mission in that sense. You know, it's in our country. Our field staff around the world, their families are also a part of this mission, because it requires sometimes for people to be gone for long extended periods of time, and having those supportive family members at home, I know it means a lot to me. And you mentioned coming back from a trip changed. If you could think of maybe the most impactful trip you've been on, what comes to mind?
I definitely can. I don't remember, maybe it was 2004. I went to India, and I, you know, it's so hard to explain, but I'll try here. I went to India, and I think for those of us who have been there, and it's pretty different from anything you experience here in North America and Central or South America. There's just really an onslaught of stimulation visually, the noise, the smells, the people. It's all kind of pressing against you in a way that's so intense. But I just remember being completely captivated by it and just in awe of the chaos of life there, but loving it. So aside from that, just aside from discovering a culture that and country that's so different from your own, life so different from your own, and there are a couple of key moments. One being, I remember driving past, I guess, I don't know what the appropriate word is to use now, but like a slum, like an entire city, it felt like, driving past it, and just seeing a level of poverty that I had never even imagined, and it felt like I was being sucker punched, and I'll never forget that memory of seeing people living in tarp cities, you know, starting little fires, and that was really intense for me. But I think the biggest thing for me as a Christian, and the biggest impactful thing for me in terms of me working for Maranatha, was I went to interview a man in a village. We were all there, and we were asking him about how God has changed their life, how finding Christianity has changed their life, the gospel. And it was through a translator, but he said, you know, before I found Jesus, I thought of myself as a pretty worthless person, full of sin and no hope for me, right? Because you have the whole belief system of reincarnation, and if you were a bad person in this life, you kind of have to live it out and then be reborn and try to do better the next time, right? But there's no sense of redemption for you in that current life. And he expressed that, and he said that now that I have Jesus in my life, like, I have hope. And being in my, you know, mid-20s and hearing that, and being somebody who grew up as a Seventh-day Adventist and grew up in the church, I think it was really shocking, and maybe it shouldn't have been, but it was really shocking to me to think of a whole culture of people who don't really have an option for redemption or hope, love in their God. And it was really huge for me to realize perhaps what I'd taken for granted my entire life to that point, the taking for granted the concept of a God who loves you and values you and that forgives you, is full of grace and love and mercy. And that was kind of a turning point for me in understanding a deeper part of why we do what we do.
When people ask why we've been in India working there for 25 years, whatever it's been, and that's part of it, that there's a great need there. And you just got back from India. Want to talk to you about that in a little bit, but wanted to keep talking about your experiences being traveling in these various countries and working for Maranatha. You mentioned just now in that story kind of a jarring moment of seeing poverty. What are some other aspects of travel that first-time volunteers may not, that they might also be jarring, that it's sort of you've gotten used to it now, almost to a comical sense, like that you it doesn't faze you at all?
Traffic, driving. Yeah. I remember I took my family on a family project to the Dominican Republic, and my husband was with me, and we were actually leading the project together, and we were in a car, and it's just traffic jams and lanes are inconsequential, and so there's just cars everywhere on the road, and my husband is looking out the window and he was going, wow, whoa, are you seeing this, Julie? Are you seeing this? And I'm completely oblivious to the craziness happening outside the car window, and I just go, oh, this is nothing. because there's India, parts of Africa you can be driving. It's just traffic is crazy everywhere.
For me, in India, the traffic is one thing, and then all of the horns and noises.
And the cows, and the random cow.
That, to me, was the next level. Hearing these little jingles that they have on some of the trucks instead of horns. And yeah. You mentioned leading the project. What has it been like for you to go on all these trips to collect stories for our magazine, television show, and then also be able to participate in a way that most people do on a mission trip? What was that experience like for you, leading a project and participating as a volunteer in a sense?
Well,
how did you connect those two, I guess, is what I was wondering. You know what I mean? The Maranatha.
Well, I actually have never been a volunteer, to be honest, just because I'm always working on a trip. So yeah, it would be kind of neat to know what it feels like to not have to worry about anything in terms of how it's going and just be that passive experiencer of a Maranatha mission trip. But in terms of leading a project, though, I've only done it once, and it was an emergency. They really needed somebody to do it for them. They weren't able to find somebody to do it, and so I was learning so quick, and I had really good help with different people mentoring me and consulting with me. But that whole experience of being a project coordinator taught me so much about how much work that job is. I mean, we were up early in the morning at the crack of dawn and didn't go to bed till midnight. Fortunately, I had a really good friend who knows my boys there, and she was helping watch my boys. And that just showed me how much energy, time, organization, customer service skills it requires to be a good project coordinator. So it gave me a whole new level of respect for projects department, for all of those people who have led projects for us. So kudos to them. But
so you go on all these trips talking about the spirit of Maranatha, basically, and you get to then be a part of it as a volunteer leader and on a volunteer project. How do those two connect? I don't know if...
One of the things that... I don't know if this really answers your question, but one of the things that I really try to do for myself when I'm on a project, as I mentioned earlier, is try to figure out what are the things that I can learn from this experience, not only about our mission, but about Christianity and my relationship with God, but also in the way the world operates or in the way different people live, and what is my responsibility as a good global citizen and as a Christian to help start thinking differently to make better change in the world. And so when we were, those are all things that I was already thinking of. And so I really wanted to bring that into the volunteer experience. So I remember when I was leading a trip, I always tried to have a thought question at the beginning of the day, because I wanted the people who were serving with us to think beyond just, I'm building a church, we're giving food to a handful of impoverished families on Christmas Day. I wanted them to really think big picture of what does this experience mean? What is the broader systematic issue of poverty? What are the things that we can really do and experience? How can we just become better people through learning about each other's lives rather than just having this experience isolated and then leaving it and coming home and returning to our regular lives? And so I tried to have thought questions up in the morning, and I would tell everybody, try to think about this throughout the day as you're working. And so if I were to lead another project, I'd want to develop that further, because I think it's really important. It's not enough for us to just go and serve and then come back to our regular lives. Something has to be applicable to our lives back here at home. And I know that we all know this, but I want everybody to have a more intentional effort on that aspect.
When you're traveling, what are some of these experiences that you try to relay to readers or viewers that might help them to understand the world better, or the country that they're reading about or watching? Are there any stereotypes that that you find that people have that maybe aren't true, that you wish, like, oh, wish that I could tell you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've talked about it in our Maranatha Mission Stories department meetings. We've talked about one of the big things that we try to think about is this concept, especially let's talk specifically about Africa. There's that concept of one Africa, where Africa is all just grass huts and people living out in rural areas with no technology, when in reality there are parts of Africa as a continent, and but specifically the countries that we work in, like Nairobi, is incredibly modern. There's other places that we've been that have an incredible amount of modernity that people don't see as much, especially when it comes to mission stories. And so I know that when we're talking, we try to tell each other, and for me personally, I try to incorporate into the script elements that we can show of a picture of a country that we're going to that contrasts with what we're seeing in our head in terms of just poverty, because that's not true. And India too. India is just such a incredibly beautiful, modern, technologically advanced place in some of the cities that we go to. And I don't want people to just think that there's only slums or, you know, out in the field with cows. It's there's just more to every place that we go to. And I guess that would be something that is important to me.
Have you ever felt in danger when you've been out in the field?
Probably, but mostly with bugs and spiders and deadly snakes. I think.
What's your best animal, insect in the room story?
Oh, I think I've only been endangered by a mere cockroach or something. it's fine. I think there was a time in Zambia where I camped out with two members of our crew, three members of our crew, and we were camping in tents in the bush. And so there was this fear of lions and snakes crawling into your tent, and especially if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. I was like the only female, and so they all had their own bathroom they could go to together. But I remember one time having to walk through tall grass to the little grass fenced hole in the ground and thinking, I hope nothing attacks me because I am all alone. But otherwise, I feel pretty safe. Our field staff take really good care of us, make sure we're okay.
They
and
do.
So, yeah, we entrust them with our lives. So,
yes, we do. What would you say is your favorite, the favorite part of your job?
My favorite part of my job is, I mean, I think obviously travel is always amazing in terms of discovering new places. It can also be the worst part of your job because you're away from your family and it can be exhausting, but it is a privilege to be able to travel the way we do. But overall, I think the best part of my job is collecting stories. It is, I guess you could say, relating back to what I said as a child, if that was my dream, to be able to tell other people's stories and also my own, it's awesome to be able to do that. But I think the people I meet, the stories I get to hear, I always tell my friends when they ask me what it's like, we get to experience parts of the world that the majority of the world does not. Right? And so we have volunteers who get to do that, but we even get to do that to a deeper level as part of the staff, because we're venturing into places that sometimes volunteers don't go. And what a privilege that is, to see these corners of the world that would otherwise never be noticed by anyone.
Always welcomed into people's homes that you've never met before, and getting to see what they, how they live. And that's pretty unique.
And there is such a beauty of belonging to a global church because of exactly what you've said. It's almost like there is a sense of family wherever you go, you know. And so, and surprisingly, there's an Adventist community somewhere that you can find hospitality from.
Anytime I go on a trip, I'm always just overwhelmed with the acceptance of whoever we're with, you know, that they are so happy that we're there. Have you ever not felt welcome somewhere? Not necessarily at an Adventist church or school anything, but just maybe you were trying to film somewhere and they didn't want you filming, or...
Oh my goodness. A couple... Well, I'm not going to name places because, you know, every country is lovely. But there are some countries that are more hostile to a camera than others. And hey, they have a right to be. We wouldn't love it if people were pointing a camera in our face. But I do remember one time I was with my colleague Leo and my colleague Tom and Anthony, who was working in Zambia with us and driving us around. And we accidentally got a flat tire in this one village. And so we were trying to fix it. And this lady came out of the village and just started yelling at us, and she was so angry, because I could be getting this wrong, but I think Anthony, who was kind of our local expert, was telling us that you almost need to be invited into these villages. You just can't be strangers that just show up. And while we weren't, I don't know if we were actually inside the village, but we were certainly very close to the perimeter of it doing this, and she didn't understand what we were doing, and she was very angry, and I was a little bit scared. So, but that's the most unwelcome I felt.
So a little abrasive person there. I am wondering, in all of your trips, who is the most touching character that you've come across? Someone that really impacted you just from your time, probably short, in being able to spend time with them and interview them possibly. Is there anyone that comes to mind?
I'm sure if I really thought about it, there would be several people that come to mind, but the one that I've actually spoken about even at convention is this woman named Margarita and her husband Felix that I met during one of my earlier, maybe some of my first projects that I went on to the Dominican Republic. And they were a couple that had were donating a part of their property for us to build a church on. And we spent the whole day with them, and we were filming all of this different footage of them praying, doing this and this and that. And that was when I had to do my first stand-up that I told you about earlier, where Dave Brillhart, who worked with us back then, had me stand up and kind of set context for this story. And just really bonded with Margarito and Felix, and they were just such lovely people. Fast forward, I don't know, I left Maranatha the first time at the end of 2005, and I returned to the Dominican Republic, I don't know, probably less than a decade ago. And I was with my colleague Leo, who is our videographer. And we were driving towards the airport, and I said, hey, to the driver, is it Boca Chica Church? Because that's the name of the church of Felix and Margarita. I said, is the Boca Chica Church on the way back to the airport? And he's like, yeah, yeah, it's right here. And so I thought, for some reason, it just kind of stuck out to me. And so he was able to take me there, and it was unrecognizable. They used to own this nursery, which had tons of plants, and it looked like the church. Back then, the churches, our standard churches, were kind of massive. And so it took up most of the property. And then there was a little house, it looked like, next to it. And I went up to it. It was all locked up. And we kind of knocked, and we were trying to see. And I was like, what are the chances they're still there? And then it took a while, and I think we were almost going to give up. And then we started to hear a voice, and this woman comes out, and I immediately recognized her. And she started like screaming and going, oh, you know, and then she she just comes out and she hugs me.
That was a scream of joy.
Yes. Okay. It was a scream of joy, not a scream of fear. But she saw me and she was kind of screaming and waving her hands. And I remember going, do you think she recognized me? And Leo was like, you don't think she recognizes you? Obviously she recognizes you. And we just hugged. And I just started crying. I don't know if it was just because it reminded me of a time when I was just starting out at Maranatha, or I was having all of these new experiences in my young life, or if it was just the idea of you rarely get to go back to a place, you know, even in our work, to connect with people that we met a decade before, you know. And so it was extraordinary. And then she showed me pictures, and then I asked her what happened to Felix, and she said that Felix died. And it really hit me. And think of all the people that, you know, we'll see again in heaven. And I remember having this ache for Margarita and for me to see Felix again, and for us to see all these people that meant something to us special in our lives, whether or not they're alive or dead on this earth currently, but that this beautiful idea of reuniting in a place, in a better home with God. So yeah, that was really special. Yeah.
Wow. Hearing that story, it just makes me think about, you know, how you started your career and all the things that have happened, and then getting to meet, you know, this person again that you know, all this time has passed. When you look back on your time with Maranatha, what would you say has changed about you as a person? I mean, how have you grown as a person through all these experiences with Maranatha?
It's so interesting. The other day I was reading something and it was talking about conversion and how do we change as people. And it's and the book talks about how, you know, sometimes we want God to change us so dramatically, you know, in that moment, boom, you know. And I confess I am guilty of expecting that too, especially when I'm looking for stories from volunteers. You want these testimonies that say, and shabam, like I was changed in an instant or within 2 weeks. But this thing I read earlier this week talked about, it told this story that says, do you see a tree and how a tree is green? And then all of a sudden, the leaves turn red. Do we see that change happening? And the person that said, no, I don't. And the person said, well, that's change happens gradually, and you don't even know it's happening. And all of a sudden, your leaves are red, but the change has happened. And that change and conversion is gradual. And I've been thinking about that idea of gradual transformation more and more in the past few years, even as I look at our volunteers and ourselves as we work here, just this idea that every day we're changing a little bit. And sometimes you won't notice it, and you don't even know. Sometimes I examine myself and think, have I really changed in a dramatic way since I've worked here? But I do think over the years, I've changed quite a bit. And one of the things that Maranatha has taught me hugely in my travel is this idea of community. And everywhere I go, one of the biggest lessons I've learned about life is, like, everywhere I go, we meet, you know this, Dustin, you meet these congregations or schools or communities that have nothing. They don't even have pastors that can be at their church every week. And maybe they see their pastor once every 3 months. And if you could imagine something like that happening here, I think we would just all be up in arms and angry about it. And there, though, they don't wait for that, they don't wait and sit back and say, well, when the pastor comes back in 3 months, you know, we'll take care of that. What they do is that they all step in. Everybody's in, right? And they say, well, I'll preach this time, and I'll handle this about the church, and I'll go out and do outreach. And they're all just so engaged in making it happen. They're not bystanders. They're not passively waiting for somebody else, the government or the church leadership or anybody to handle it for them. They're doing everything they can to get involved and make a change. And I feel like I've learned a tremendous amount from that attitude, and I've been able to apply that in my own life, in my own home community, in my own church. This idea that no one has to serve us. We serve each other, and we step in and we are proactive about getting engaged and making that positive change wherever you are. And we're all in it together, and community doesn't work unless we're all in. So
yeah, it's hard to describe how important, how central the life of the church is for a lot of these congregations. I remember you telling me one time too, just growing up in the Korean community, how important the church is for the Korean community. And it seems like, has that played a role at all in how you relate to some of these congregations, or not necessarily?
I don't know if necessarily. I mean, it's certainly...
just growing up, from my perspective, commuting to church every Sabbath, maybe 30 minutes to our church, it's totally different experience, right? And so being able to see that for myself on some of these trips where people come to church maybe almost every day, and it is just this rock in their community, even if things aren't going well around them, like that is the central place where they live life together. And anyway, just different from how I grew up.
I researched and wrote an article when I was in just out of college about church communities and what you brought up in terms of immigrant communities and immigrant churches and the importance of that. And a lot of it is because sometimes you're in a place and you're somewhat marginalized, right? You're not part of the mainstream, so maybe it's language or cultural barriers. And in some of these places that we visit, it's probably more just where you live, or maybe you don't have the money, and a lot of the places we visit, people are just living from day to day, right? They're subsistence farmers, or they're just doing day laborers, and so they don't have a lot of rank or power in society. But that church communities are a bit of a microcosm of society, and that they provide a place where people can belong, where people are needed, where people can have a voice. And yeah, I guess I do see a lot of that in the places that we are visiting. And that certainly, I could see that in our churches when I was growing up in my Korean church. And then I think I can see that in a lot of the places we visit. These are people who probably wouldn't hold public office, or they wouldn't be listened to out in their cities or societies. But in church, they have a voice, and in church, they feel that they have a community and they can make a difference.
And can take on some leadership. And mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. It's really important.
I want to ask you about our magazine, The Volunteer. Okay. You're the editor mm-hmm. in chief of our quarterly magazine, The Volunteer. Mm-hmm. Why does Maranatha have a magazine? I mean, in this day and age where a lot is going digital, why do we still have a print magazine?
I get asked that question after every magazine from our president. He asks, hey, do you know if we still need a magazine? And I think we do. I think people are still readers, and not everybody has transferred over to digital reading, you know, reading online. And the written word, we can tell stories in a different way from the show. I know videos are so popular, and they satiate a certain part of ourselves wanting to just be passively informed or entertained. But I think that reading is still, I think it's still important to people.
Reading is important. The more you know.
But the storytelling that we can do in the magazine and the information we can share in the magazine always allows for a little bit more detail. And it's just different. It's a different way of processing information, and like, we just need all the different channels we can take.
You mentioned that story about Carl Schwinn and his time in Afghanistan. What is the most memorable story you've ever written for the magazine?
Probably Carl's story. Yeah. I mean, if you haven't, you can go look for it in our archives or call us or something. But it's just an extraordinary story of Carl Schwinn going out to Afghanistan, dealing with the Taliban, trying to build a hospital in Kabul, and some of the incredible danger that he went through, and kind of the post-traumatic syndrome he suffered afterwards. But it was also memorable because it was my first real, like, long-form article on a person that I'd written. And I was flown out to Arizona to talk to him. And I'm sure Carl wouldn't mind me saying this, but Carl is a very detailed person. So he is somebody that we sat down, I remember, and I wanted to ask him about a couple, but he was like, no, Julie, we've got to start from the beginning. So we had to, like, basically start from when he was a small child or something. But we went through the whole timeline of his life, and you know, that can take a while. But in the end, it was I was really proud of that story.
Maybe we could get it online.
I wonder who could do that. Dustin.
I'll work on that. Another thing that you do for Maranatha is put on a huge event known as Mission Maranatha, our annual convention. Could be upwards of 2,000 people at this event. What is it like trying to plan an event of this scale every year?
Well, I think I'm really, really, really fortunate because I have an incredible team of people. We work, I do not work alone. We work with different people as members of the convention committee, and we meet on a regular basis as the time comes near to talk about musical selection, flow, the different speakers we're going to have. And it's a lot. It's always a lot of pressure. I think the hardest part is two things. One is hoping people show up, and two is making sure that you have the right stories to be shared. And so typically, you and Christina Lloyd, our director of television, we work together to start calling different people that we've received hints or heads up from other people that, hey, that person might have an incredible testimony to share. And so we interview people and start to consider whether or not this is the right story to be shared at convention. So,
what's the goal of convention?
The goal is to inform people about the work that Maranatha has done in the past year, has been doing, and is planning to do the next year, and of course to inspire them to get involved.
It's quite an undertaking, and talk about anxiety on trips. There's also some anxiety here at the office leading up to that event, because what are all the elements behind the scenes that people don't realize go into this production?
Well,
and if you've never been to it, it is a top-notch, I just have to say.
Like to say so too.
No, but as someone that, you know, I've been at Maranatha for 6 years, so it's still relatively recent in my memory, that first convention. It is a high quality show that airs on 3ABN and Hope Channel, but it's also a personal event that people come to and get to meet other like-minded volunteers, get to hear testimonies. Sorry, I think I'm taking my question away
from
you.
Please take it away. Take it away.
But yeah, I don't remember what my question was, but
I think it's, well, I think you asked about what are the elements that go into it. I think in recent years, I think Christina was saying the other day, like, I think we had like 47 different videos for convention or something. It was just an incredible amount of 2 to 3 minute videos plus 30 second videos. Just, we have kind of a seamless approach to what we do, a whole run sheet of the different sessions we have for convention that take account of literally every single second, because it's also broadcast live on television and streamed online. And so we have to make sure that everything fits within that allotted time where it's going to be broadcast live on 3ABN, Hope Channel, etc., right? And we can't go over or we'll get cut off by the next show. And so we really do try to take note of every single minute, and then creating these videos in between speakers, so it's just not a, you know, 2.5 hours of people talking, but they're all, people are able to kind of visually see and receive information that through a visual medium too. And so it's a lot. It's a lot of coordination.
There's a lot of consideration too, a lot of discussion about what makes sense to follow the next thing. How do we unravel this story of Maranatha in a program?
In the flow. John Noble always talks about, what's the flow? Let's live this thing, you know? And it's true. We kind of go through it and talk about what song from the singer's repertoire should we put here, you know? We need a big open. We need something more mellow here. And so there is, like I said, we just think about every single minute of that program.
And you often we'll do an offering appeal during one of the programs. But other than that, what is your role during the program? The people may not see you during the program, but you're there.
Yeah, so typically I'm sitting in the front row on one of the sides. Usually it's the left side of the church, and I am directing people on and off the stage, and I also have a headset on, and so I'm communicating with, you know, Christina, who's in the back room, who's watching all the screens, working with the director, and we're talking to each other about how many seconds does that person have left, who's loaded to get on stage next, and so I'm giving cues to people to get on, cues to get off. If you start going over and you're ignoring the time clock, I'll kind of army crawl over to the podium and just tell them, wrap it up, wrap it up. And so that's the main role I take during that day, where I'm just sitting there and making sure that we're following the run sheet, staying on time, and cueing people.
It's a huge undertaking, and there's a lot involved with it. And some people might wonder, okay, is all of this, you know, worth it? Like, what's, and even our president every year asks, like, hey, or should we do this again or not? So why do you think we continue to host an annual convention every year? What does it provide people?
I think that most of the people who come really enjoy it or are spectacularly blessed by it, they say. And I think it not only, it serves a very practical purpose for Maranatha, right? It gives a ton of information, but hopefully in a very interesting and inspiring way to a group of people who know us and love us, and also people who are getting to know us. And I think it's a very efficient way to do that. But it also provides a space for people who have volunteered to come back and see each other again, or to make new friends of people who have had these shared mission experiences. And you see a lot of kind of love and connection happening on these trips or on these during these conventions, where people are just excited to see each other, to see the Maranatha staff that they maybe served with in the field or talk to on the phone. And so it's a real moment of reunion.
Even one of our new colleagues, Sydney Needles, in our department, her first convention was just several months ago, and she said immediately, I felt like I was a part of this community, even though I just entered, recently.
Definitely a family.
Yeah.
Another thing I think that we do that is interesting, I was just talking to a friend, somebody new I just met and is now a friend, and they were talking about how churches, they feel like, don't do the testimony anymore. He doesn't feel like there's enough of people featuring how God has changed their life, these personal testimonies. And I was thinking, oh, that's what we do at convention. We really focus, and that's everybody's favorite part, is that idea of telling personal stories of how God has changed their life. And so that's important.
Usually the reason people come on a Maranatha mission trip is because someone invited them. Yeah. There are people that just find out about Maranatha and go to the website, but a lot of times it's that invitation
word
of someone
of mouth,
else, and hearing someone's testimony is a similar kind of invitation to get involved and join.
Yeah, I do think a lot of people who go on mission trips go in search of something. I do think people go seeking something to change inside of them. They want to have a revelation. They want to have a transformation, big or small. And so going to convention and hearing that it does happen for people, it does touch your life and change your life, affirms kind of what they're seeking.
That's interesting. Okay, we've been talking a lot about your journey with Maranatha, kind of the past, but let's talk about now and recent history. You just went to India. You've talked about India a few times already, but tell us what you saw on this trip. You went to the Binjapali school. What are we doing there?
The Binjapali school is a school in Orissa, the state of Orissa, and we are building a new campus for them, and mainly doing some renovations, tearing down some buildings and building new ones. It's a campus that when I went there, we had already partially built some things, like the new kitchen and a dining hall, which is wonderful, because their old kitchen I saw and it was just black soot everywhere, and they said it was just a horrible situation, and kids were handed their food through kind of these metal bars like a prison. The new kitchen, of course, has an exhaust system, and it's just stoves, and it's beautiful, and the kids can eat inside a cafeteria instead of spreading out. They would have to eat in their dorms if it's raining, or under the tree during this when it's hot. We're building new dormitories, new staff housing, new classrooms, renovating existing classrooms, new bathrooms, landscaping. It's going to be
Principal's house.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a transformation.
What was the living conditions, or what is it right now for some of the kids there?
So when I went, we went into the kids' the girls' dormitory, and it was just this long kind of series of buildings stuck together, concrete, but crumbling, and it was dark. There were no direct sunlight coming into the buildings, and it was just smaller rooms that had a bunch of bunk beds crammed into it, and so there just isn't enough room. I think they told me there were about 200 kids who are residential students there, and the girls' we're all sleeping two to a bunk bed, so four per bunk bed set. And then their bedtime routine is when they come in, there's a few girls assigned to just sweep the floor in the middle and then set out mats and blankets. And so there are some girls who have to sleep on the floor. And even sleeping on the floor, it's not like it's spacious. They're kind of crammed in there like sardines. And the same situation with the boys. The boys really just took, some of them had a similar dorm situation as the girls, but the majority of them were in a converted classroom space. So every night they have to put away the desks and then set up beds. And interestingly, like, they took the benches that they sat on, flipped them over, and then you have the four legs of the benches sticking up, and they had two of them, and they hooked their mosquito netting over it to create this really low-level cage that they crawled into. And those benches maybe seat two students, maybe three really skinny students during the day, but they would cram about four bodies into that netted space. And they were, like I said, just shoulder to shoulder. But the other thing was just, especially in the girls' dorm, their bathrooms were connected to the space. And it just, the smell was so awful because, you know, these are not, there are holes in the ground, and it's just right next to the girls' room, and it's holes in the roof, holes in the walls, and it's just everything wafting through. To think about sleeping in a space that just smells like a sewer was really upsetting to me, to think that they have to live in a space like this. And so, yeah.
How do you avoid getting used to seeing these kinds of conditions and it not affecting you? Do you know what I mean? Because the more you see something, the less impactful it might be.
I can't say that I've been totally successful at not being, what's the word, calloused to that. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen a lot over the last so many years that I've worked at Maranatha, and sometimes you see things and you're like, all right, yeah, it's a poorly built church, or it's a poorly built dorm. And it happens. It happens, and I wish it didn't. And you kind of sometimes have to remind yourself to take it all in again, as if though it's the first time, especially because it's your job to translate that to the viewer or to the reader. In India, I was really, I don't know why, because it's not like it's the first time I was back to India since that time I went in my earlier years at Maranatha. But I think there was something about stepping into that dorm space and having not just my eyes see the terrible conditions, but having the smell of the bathrooms nearby, and just these kids being crammed in there and the hole in the roof. And in fact, when I was there the first time day I went, the girls were all standing on blocks in the bathroom to brush their teeth because water had flooded. So it was literally like a wading pool in there, and they had to stand on blocks so their feet wouldn't get wet, and they're trying to brush their teeth. And I just remember thinking, this is no way for these kids to live. And then the next day I interviewed some of the students for the show, and I talked to a girl, a couple of the kids, and I was asking them, and I said, so tell me about your dorms. And I thought, for sure they're going to talk about, oh, well, it's terrible, it's awful. But they said, oh, it's very nice. And at first I was kind of disappointed. I'm like, that's not the answer I need for my show. I need them to talk about how awful it is so people will want to help them. But I quickly realized that two things. One, these kids are not from wealthy families. They're coming from poor families, and they're also, most of them are on scholarship from other Adventist organizations that are donating money to provide tuition for these kids, which is incredible, right? We all have to work together. It's not just Maranatha helping this school, it's other organizations too. So for some of these kids, these dorms, as awful as they may seem to me, are actually pretty good for them. Which is just, everything's relative, right? And that's a big wake-up call for me to have from time to time. It's good for me to remember how relative things can be in a society. And then the other thing is that it just made me think about, I just couldn't wait, Dustin. I couldn't wait until they were going to see the new dormitory they were going to have. You know, like, I thought, wow, if you think this is nice, just wait till you see what we're building for you. And wait till you see what it's like to be in a bed by yourself. and wait till you see what it's like to have electricity, like good lights and a real bathroom and toilet, and not have to spit toothpaste on the floor. And just you wait, kid. Just you wait till you see it. And it just made me really think about how so much of what we do, that moment encapsulated what we do as a mission organization. We provide a level of living conditions, study conditions, worship conditions, physical, structural things that are sometimes beyond the wildest dreams of the people receiving them. But beyond that, that's what our message of hope does too in the gospel, right? That the message of love and grace is so much greater than a lot of people who don't know this, that they can't even imagine. Like that first man I talked to on my first trip to India, where he was always just felt like he was a lost cause, and then to find that there was a God who believed in him and would give him that hope. I think that's something that he could have never imagined until he heard about Jesus Christ. And all of that kind of came together in that moment when I was interviewing that girl, thinking, you know, this is a place that provides an education soaked in hope because it's based in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that hope is greater than anything you could have ever imagined, kid. So just you wait.
Well, I think we should probably end there. That's probably no better place to end.
Yeah, that would be good.
Julie, thank you so much for your time today, but also for everything that you've done to share the story of Maranatha with so many people for so many years. And I love working with you. We are so lucky to have you. And anyway, thank you so much for being on Inside Missions.
Thank you. It was an honor.